Welcome, everyone, to the Our Strange Skies podcast. I am your host, Rob Christofferson, and I'm joined today by Stephanie Quick. She is a writer, an investigator of the weird, ranging from areas such as sex magic to synchronicities to UFOs to everything. And if you follow her on Twitter at Wandering Britches, you know how much of a fashion icon she is. Stephanie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. That's really sweet. No, I'm excited to be here today.
It's weird because when I wanted to do an episode about this particular incident, and I kept thinking in my head, who am I going to have on for this? Who am I going to have on for this? And for some reason, your name popped into my head. And after that, there was just this wave of synchronicities that happened that just made it seem like this was fated to happen. It had to happen. So not only are we going to be talking about the Trancas incident, but also the synchronicities that have brought this episode together.
Yeah, it's this is one of those things that interests me. I've been interested in synchronicities and the paranormal since I was little, but then synchronicities, especially about the last 20 years, and I've been engaging with them in terms of trying to run like synchronicity experiments. We specifically go through a period you're trying to like drum them up and kind of see what happens and what it can tell you about the phenomenon or about yourself. But one of the things that I've noticed about the paranormal is that, as Phil from Weird Studies puts it tends to tell on you, right?
Right.
So it to me, it has that intersection with sex magic in that the erotic force is always trying to break the bounds and it's revealing. I mean, like it was the Scarlet Letter, Nathaniel Hawthorne, right? That everything would have been on the down low except for, well, people get pregnant and then all what everyone's been up to comes to light, right?
Right.
Because the erotic is an anti-structural force in society and life. I mean, that's the whole point of sex, is to make something new. And instead of the same old thing, we could just be like clones or like amoebas, just like kind of potting off and just have that. I mean, that could make plenty of life, but you don't get the new excitement. But I think the paranormal in its relationship with the trickster really emphasizes as well this bringing up of hidden, taboo, personal, emotionally charged material. Like you think of a lot of the tropes of the, the ghost that comes back from the grave to point the finger at its murderer, right? The Teresita, I think it Teresa Batista.
Awesome. Yeah.
It was a very intense experience where a woman's coworker had been murdered, and the coworker came to her in dreams and pointed them towards actually evidence that this another person who I believe they all worked at a hospital had murdered her. And this is like a classic trope going back hundreds of years, ghosts pointing to buried treasure or to hidden wills, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then you see, I think that in the Mothman prophecies, this kind of a funny aspect of this is you get these UFOs showing up in lovers' lanes. Yep. And people getting sunburns from exposure to the light from the UFO and conjunctivitis. And he kind of puts it a little mildly, but you know, if people are out there naked, right, and getting sunburns in all these places, it's like, well, what are you doing out there? Who are you with? Or are you naked? It's
right.
Like 1960, whatever. Right. So it's like revealing these things that people like to keep quiet or that are taboo.
Yeah.
So I feel like, because there's a lot of push towards normalizing the paranormal, which I think on the whole is very admirable pursuit. And I think there's a lot we could do to help people interact with all these phenomena in a way where they can maintain their emotional and material stability, social stability, mm-hmm. More than can, because you know, anyone listening to the show knows you have a lot of people. I thought your recent show about Carl Higdon was very good, just to show how everything, all your stability is just like shattered just to the nature of this experience. And people can get, have it be really bad. And I'm interested in what can we do to help make this so it doesn't have to be as bad for people. This happens classically with like near-death experiences as well. But I think that there's something inherently shattered about the paranormal that just, it wants to shake things up, and it's going to be hard even if you normalize it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And even with the Carl Higdon case, and I think what's interesting and what I totally left out of that I forgot to mention, because it was Leo Sprinkle that did the hypnosis on that case, mm-hmm. when he specifically talked about the quote unquote craft, he talked about it as if it was an extra dimensional space, but also that it would move like a spaceship would. So that was it in that area, you know, crossing the bounds, it kind of just like blew my mind, and I completely left it out of the episode.
No, stuff like that. I mean, that's the type of thing where you're going to have like what, like an ontological epistemological crisis. Cause it's like, how can this exist?
Right.
And I experienced it.
Right. And with this case in particular, the Trancas incident, it's supposedly one of the inspirations that Steven Spielberg used for Close Encounters of the Third Kind, though I couldn't really find any other information other than, you know, some UFO investigators kind of mentioning it in like certain programs and in certain articles and stuff like that. And I think it definitely could be an influence on the film, just given how influential this case is, and yet how, at the same time, how little it's known outside of the United States or outside of Argentina. It's definitely not as well known in the United States, I would say. But this case is, it took place on October 21st, 1963, on the Santa Teresa Ranch in Trancas, and it involves the way that people and investigators talk about this case. It seems to be a very watered down version of what you get now, but in a 1971 article written by Oscar A. Galindez, and Oscar Galindez, man, he formed a UFO research group with his dad, and like I want to do that now. You know, I wish my dad was around so we could go hunt UFOs together, because it's just like, you know, it's just,
well, and this is getting towards part of the synchronicity about this, because this whole, to me, a lot of what I notice about this case is it's centered on family. And a mother and a baby, and the grandparents are there. So it's a very family experience. But when you recommended this case to me, the first thing I thought was, oh, Trancas. Well, I several years ago, I moved to Napa, California to live with my mom, because she had a very bad back fracture and was moving her house. And so I came in, and since then I've lived with her. She's getting a little older, and her skeleton is not what it should be.
Yeah.
But I'd never heard the name Trancas anywhere before, except for it's one of the main roads in the town of Napa. And I spent a lot of time along there because it's where we have the Queen of the Valley Hospital, right? Named after the Virgin Mary. And all her doctors and everything are really along Trancas. So I thought that was interesting. Then, as you said, this takes place in fall of 1963.
Yep.
I don't know why my dog is going crazy. But I noticed that right away, because it mentions first in the article that the main witness, her husband is in the Air Force. My brother is retired Air Force. And he actually had lived with my mom in Napa for a while too. And I thought, so I had him in mind. And then as I'm reading along, that this incident took place just like about 2 months after he was born, which is interesting. And then later on in the article, his actual birthday is in there. the month and day. So these type of things start happening that made it seem kind of like more personally related to me. This is the trouble, because you talk about these things revealing hidden information, and I don't want to be giving out like all my family's name and everything. I mean, right. to verify this stuff, I sent you my driver's license and a piece of mail addressed to me and my current address.
You did. It felt kind of like someone submitting an application for something. And I'm like, okay, yeah.
But you know, I mean, it's like, yeah. You can say, yeah, hey, that's my birthday. But then, you know, yep. Right.
Absolutely.
So that's the thing, is when people say, well, you know, this is one of my pet peeves. Well, you know, synchronicities are okay, but the symbolism, it's also personal. It's like, yeah, this is personal, but verifiable, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, yeah. So I didn't know that it was an influence. I've actually never seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
You really haven't? Really?
Speaking of scandalous information that comes to light.
It is scandalous now. You have set this podcast into a tizzy right now. No, I'm just kidding. But it's I've seen it twice, I think. But as someone who has like read too many cases, you can kind of see the influences in certain areas and stuff. And I think you can see the influence of this case on certain scenes in the film. Because from what I understand and from what Mark O'Connell's biography of J. Allen Hynek, the Close Encounters man, brought up, Spielberg supposedly talked to not only Vallée and Hynek, but he allegedly talked to Lonnie Zamora and a few other UFO witnesses. So just given the case, just like the case histories that he would have, it's really not surprising that, you know, a case like this would end up on his table. But the three main witnesses that they always talk about in this case, Yoli de Vallée Moreno, Argentina Moreno de Chavez, and a domestic servant named Dora Martina Guzman, they're usually like singled out as like the three main witnesses in this case, and they do play a significant part. But when Oscar Galindez and a couple of other investigators went back, interviewed members of the family 7 years later, what they found was that it wasn't just these three, it was practically the entire family that was living in this, on the ranch at the time, saw this entire, at least most of this event take place. Not only that, one of the UFOs, in fact, the UFO that they call the mothership, was only like 15 feet outside of their house, just like hovering above the ground, which is that's unnerving as hell.
And I have to say, some of the observations that these people made, I thought were very precise and very canny, especially given because the main witness was a young mother who was like, I think 28 or something, and she had a babe in arms. Mm-hmm. And you know, so they're panicking, running through the house, trying to figure out what's going on, protect the baby, go out and see what the heck is going on there. And I was really impressed with the type of observations about like the particular properties of the light that was being cast by this, that people were able to make in those very trying circumstances, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. This event starts kind of around 7 PM with the evening meal. It wasn't long after they had started eating that their power actually went out. They had a substation on their property, which just judging from the article kind of supplied power for a bunch of people in the area. It was owned by the family, but they had all turned in early that night because they lost power. So Yoli was still awake when the rest of the family had gone to bed. She had just had her newborn baby and she was waiting for a feeding at 9:30. And Dora Martina Guzman, the domestic servant, she saw that she was still up and she knocked on her door and she was immediately frightened. She struggled to kind of vocalize what she was terrified of. And she kind of just excused herself for a minute before, you know, quickly coming back, saying that she could see these lights coming from their back courtyard. And she continued to have difficulty kind of putting these lights into perspective at first, because there was no sign of storm clouds in the sky. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these kind of these lights would appear and disappear in intervals and stuff. So Dora Martina was actually threatening to leave, you know, with many of her chores still undone, I guess. And this prompted Yoli and her sister Yolanda, who was living with the her parents, to go out to the courtyard. And to the far left, toward the Belgrano railway line, the three witnesses saw two lights that were connected by this long tube. And when you see the sketch that I'm going to include in the show notes of this thing, they can see approximately 40 silhouettes moving within this tube of light. And when I had John Tenney on to cover the Catman Batman of Argentina, we talked about how there were these sightings of what they called train-like objects going back into the 60s, like 1962. And this kind of fits in, I would say it would fit into that structural framework, especially when you look at the sketch, because it does look like a giant like train, like almost kind of like a monorail type thing, in which you know, these witnesses, these like figures are inside of it doing a bunch of things. It's a very weird looking sketch.
It's creepy. And I don't know why I've just been feeling kind of like cosmically, mystically inclined today. I was just really struck by the whole thing of, you know, you have this new mother and her father's not there. Her father's like, or not, the father of her child is not there, right? He's in the Air Force, right? He's like up in the sky. Are we getting a theme here, right?
Right.
Because of how much in especially later UFO lore, there's a whole idea of like hybrid children and the union between the earth people and the sky people. Because that sketch is very weird to me because it's very technological looking, right?
Yes.
Like at the same time, it really looks very phallic with a lot of these little beings in there, just like in the Middle Ages, like the sperms coming out, right?
Right. Yeah. No.
It's absolutely like the glowing sky coming to impregnate. And the main witnesses, I think Dora Martina, she was only in her, she's like 15 or 17 or something.
Yeah. Yeah. She's a teenager.
Which is interesting that she was so freaked out that she just wanted to bug out, you know, even though she's just like, you know, a very young woman saying, you know, fuck this noise. I'm going to go out there in the wilderness. Yep. Because they were more or less isolated. But yeah, so it's like there's this, on the one hand, it's very technological, but then it also has this these real themes of babies and the whole kind of lurking in the background. So I don't know.
Yeah, now that I'm looking at the sketch again, really, would definitely say that the penis-y is definitely a word that comes to mind while looking
double-headed, at this. Double-headed, no less.
Yes, yes.
It's like the glowing sky is coming at you.
Yep.
I would scream too. The more I think about, the more I'm impressed with these young women and their fortitude in the face of these cosmic forces.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Like, and the thing is that in most of the retellings of this case that I've ever read or I've ever seen, they totally leave this part of it out every time. So I don't know why. I don't think it really subtracts from the credibility of the witnesses or the events in this case, but it's just like, it's interesting because it kind of takes it from a, you know, close encounter of the second kind to a close encounter of the third kind, which, you know, fits with the theme if it really was used as inspiration for the movie. And so they see these like, they describe them as normal human looking figures, mm-hmm. just like passing back and forth, walking by each other. It's just very strange, in terms of like UFO witnesses watching humanoid beings doing strange things on crafts. This one is just very, it's hard to put into words because I've never come across anything like this before. I don't even know how to sum it up. It's just, it seems very symbolic in a way, even from the description itself.
Yeah, because it's like usually you just see kind of like, it seems like a lot of the reports are just like a pod or kind of a bubble thing, and you just see a couple figures. What was the one in Papua New Guinea, I think, and the guy who didn't have his glasses on?
Oh, yeah, father. Yeah. The William Gill. Yeah.
In that instance, there was like a lot, I think, of figures on the craft.
There was like four, I want to say, at maximum. They, you know, okay. But I mean, it was over the course of 2 to 3 nights. So,
yeah.
But like,
but these are like about, a crowd.
Yeah, this is definitely a crowd that is just showing up on this, this here ranch. You know, it's a perfect time to show up, you know, disturb people.
Basically.
Yeah. Like, people are trying to sleep. You couldn't have picked a better time? All right, I guess.
Let's shut the power off so you turn in and then wake you up. It also reminds me too of like a lot of let's say medieval or Renaissance paintings where you have like a picture of hell or heaven or something, and it's just like the legions and legions and legions of creatures in there doing all their things.
Yep. I can definitely envision that out in my brain. I'm sure I'll dream about it tonight or something.
You're welcome.
So, like, to get a better view of this, they actually had to like drop to their knees so they could see underneath the vegetation, because it's kind of interesting the way that the property is kind of set up, because their house is basically surrounded by a semicircle of trees. The sisters briefly return to their room so they could get dressed, go out there and get a better look. They retrieved a flashlight and the Colt 38, because I mean, they were kind of under the impression at first that it was maybe like, guerrilla fighters coming, onto their property, or, you know, like poachers or something like that. Yeah. But Yoli tiptoed to Argentina's room and asked her to look after her son while she was gone. And, you know, Argentina's just like imploring her not to go out there. You know, it really could be guerrillas, saboteurs, you know, whatever responsible. But Yoli was quick to refuse. And that was when Argentina moved outside briefly to see the lights for herself, and she cried out in fear, saying that she could see machines near the house.
That's so creepy sounding.
Yeah. I don't like it either. I don't.
I would encourage people just at this point to say that Flying Saucer Review article you linked me to, if people want to take a look at those nice sketches there of the craft and a map of the incident and everything. It gives you some insight into how their observations were made and what was going on there. And it's like you say, it's I don't want machines next to the house.
No. And like you see, like, it, you know, so the way that they have it laid out, figure one is kind of this layout of the house and everything like that. And I'm assuming that this line right here is kind of is a gate, a fence and a gate, but like right on the other side of this long fence is this huge, gigantic UFO. They eventually see it when after they head back outside, they ended up, I think, shining their flashlight on it. And that's when this thing just kind of came to life. All of these lights on it just lit up. And also by this time, their parents had woken up. Antonio Moreno Ibach and Teresa Cruz de Moreno, they were now awake, seeing that there was like so much activity going on in the house. They could see these lights. And, you know, Yoli, Yolanda, and Dora Martina, they're heading towards the railroad tracks. And again, they're trying to rationalize what is going on here, you know, thinking that it was actually a truck with an employee that was driving up. So Dora was going to go up to this large fence that had a gate door in it, and she was going to go up and open it up. And that when she went up there, Yoli shone the flashlight on this kind of like green light that they could see like right there. And suddenly six windows burst forth with light, illuminating a disc-shaped object that was hovering just off the ground, 14 feet away from their home. Quote, it was a solid body, some 28 to 30 feet in diameter, its surface appearing to be of metal, resembling aluminum. It had a number of sections fitted together with protuberances that looked like rivets. And I think that part of the description is interesting, because most UFOs that people describe, they don't see like rivets or anything on it that seems like, you know, a solid structure. But this thing looks like it's been, you know, riveted together.
Yeah.
And on the top of it, it had a dome, likewise of a metallic appearance, but darker and with no rivets. There were no emblems or markings on the object. The small windows were rectangular, about 35 inches by 25 inches, and emitted a powerful white light. The rest of the surface of the machine could not be seen because of a whitish mist coming out of its lower extremity. From the dome to the bottom of the windows, the distance was about 8 to 10 feet, and from the bottom of the windows to the ground was only another 5 feet. The machine was rocking gently to and fro, but not revolving on its axis. It was quite clearly not resting on the ground. So this object is pretty big. And to be that close to my house, I would not be happy about that. That's just, yeah.
I mean, it's like way too close to the house. It is uncanny in every respect, that it's like just sitting there, just kind of like rocking on this fog just above the ground. Mm-hmm. And then, but it's put together with rivets. So it's kind of like almost like a signature of it being made by people, along with the people inside that they saw previously looking like people. Right. So it's like this weird thing of like, very uncanny, very much not our normal type of technology, anything that we know about or would expect. But at the same time, it's like these signifiers that, oh, we just riveted it together with these people that are inside running it.
Yeah. And way too close for comfort. And again, like when you look at this sketch, this layout, the plans of this house, I just get uneasy looking at it every single time, because that UFO is just, it's right on the other side of that gate. You see the tube like objects, about 150 yards away from the house. So they had a pretty good view of it, when all that was going down. And, there a lot more is going to start happening. So through the windows, they could see this like band of lights that was coming to life inside the machine, and they would rotate, and the windows changed color in a slow sequence that made it seem like the actual object was spinning, even though it wasn't. It was just kind of rocking side to side, which is, again, kind of unsettling to think about that it would do that. Like, because like the picture that comes into my mind is like that quintessential horror picture of someone who is like clearly crazy rocking themselves back and forth. That's the image I get in my head right now.
Or even just like a boat, mm-hmm. except for this is the air and there's no.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even, you know, and even that big of a boat on that amount of even just water, mm-hmm. it would not work. So, yeah. So it's very uncanny because it's kind of cueing into these things but it does not work. I have to mention at this point, part of why this creeps me out is, again, getting to the whole, like, why would this be for me? So I'm actually live about that close to a train track, because I live in Napa and we have the wine train that goes by. It's very close. I mean, you could sit in the house and hear the train and the horn going by. It's a lot of fun. Sometimes the dogs will bark at it because it's that close. And I think about like my dog, Oliver, he's like 7 pounds barking at this huge engine. But the other thing that gets me about it being so close and you not knowing is that we're also in the path of a flight of hot air balloons that they fly for the tourists.
Yep.
And they're really big. And they're incredibly silent. And I'll have the experience more than once of you'll be outside in the morning and you'll have no idea. And then all of a sudden you'll hear it, the flare of the gas, or you'll happen to see it. And this thing is just like right there and you had no idea.
Yeah. That's which unsettling.
It is. And some of those will be like low and just behind the houses, or sometimes they'll get like close down here where like way too close because they're on fire.
Yeah.
Which I have, you know, then you take pictures so you can complain to the city.
Yep. Yeah.
But I love them, but it's very creepy when you don't, it's like something's like this huge fire breathing dragon, essentially craft. Mm-hmm. You have no idea it's there. So I like that aspect. I thought that they, and like you say, especially if you look at the map of the house and everything and the hen coop, it really gives you a feeling for what they were observing and how close everything was. And it's so creepy. I mean, even just seeing something like this, like a couple football fields away, would be creepy.
Oh, yeah. Like new fears are being ignited in my brain, and I'm sure the morning walks to work at 2:30 in the morning, 3:30 in the morning will not be affected at all. You know, it's totally fine.
But it gets to these witnesses. I think they're very brave and really kept their head and looked at the whole at the time in the moment. And then afterwards, you could tell that they're really taking kind of a analytical view to their experience, which really adds a lot to, I think they noticed a lot of very interesting details about everything that went on, which makes this a very captivating report.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's what, made even like Kenneth Arnold's sightings so special, is that like the whole time while he was observing everything in the air, he's doing his best to like measure everything, you know, mm-hmm. from the size of the object to how fast it was going to, you know, anything that he could think of, you know, so much going so far as to hold up like a fastener that he had that kind of keeps the skin on his plane and just like, yeah, I'm going to eyeball it here and measure it. And like, yeah, I have a certain respect for witnesses that just like come at you with so many details that like your eyes glaze over and you just love it, you know?
No, it's fascinating. And I think, you know, some people are naturally inclined that way, but then if you, let's say if you're an amateur astronomer or you're a bird watcher, like, you know, you have training flying or something, that you're kind of trained to make certain observations as part of your hobby or your job. Then it can come in really handy at times like this. You see something very unusual, you have more the presence of mind and the tools to make some observations that could be useful later. So,
yeah, Yeah, absolutely. This object was, you know, it was producing this white mist, and it started to get thicker and thicker, and it gave off this sulfurous odor, which, you know, kind of gets your, like, you know, demon vibes going here, you know, sulfurous odors and such. It's too much. I don't want anything sulfurous, like, near me at any time. It smells terrible. And, you know, that's just spreading all over the place. It's terrible. But they also kind of seem to be mesmerized by this object a little bit. And because they just kind of stood and stared at it. And, like, there was this sudden burst of flame that brought them back into reality. And it pushed them back about 6 feet, according to them. Dora Martina, because she had moved closer, was later treated for first and second degree burns on her face, arms, and legs. Which is, yeah.
That's right. That's severe.
Yeah, it's intense. Like, first and second degree burns. Like, even I didn't get a full gauge on how close she got. I don't know if she made it to the gate door before she shined the flashlight on it, but just being closer, yeah, this is some serious stuff. And in response to the flames from the one, three more sets of lights came to life, coming from the railway line at different points along it. And they could all, you know, them outside, they could see these points of light that were coming from the railway line. And the band of lights inside the object seemed to increase, moving faster and faster. And the mist just continued to pour out of it, enveloping the object completely to the point where none of the structure was visible anymore. From the windows in Argentina's room, the Moreno parents kind of saw everything from that vantage point. And a tube of light came from the top of the object, performing what they presumed to be kind of a scan of the house. They just saw from the top of it, the dome on the top, just this light that, yeah, just kind of seemed to be, like, I don't know, scanning its... scanning the structures around it and stuff. And from two rooms away, in the room Yolanda had shared with her sister Yoli, they saw two beams of light projecting from one of the objects on the tracks. And it was, and the way that they describe it is just super creepy, because it moves incredibly slowly, and it stops just short of a shed next to the house. They said it took like minutes to make it there, like this slow creeping beam that it never quite touched the ground. It kind of just like hovered above it a little bit, like 3 or 4 inches or so. And this tube of light, it remained there for approximately 40 minutes. That's excessive, you know. Yeah. It's too much.
It is. And it's so weird, too, because it's like, even if you just see something briefly that seems to invalidate what you know about how the world works, it's enough to throw you off. But then you get this thing, and it's like, you know that this is not how light behaves, but it's just doing it for over half an hour, whether you like it or not.
So the real question here now is, do these aliens have lightsabers?
Because right. Well, it seems pretty apparent they do.
Yes, they have somehow been able to stop, you know, light from moving forward. So it's clear they have the lightsabers. And if Star Wars had been out at this time, it would be a totally different game changer. I'm blowing my mind with these revelations right now.
Well, that's the thing, too, that because you know that if you had if they made these exact same observations, given the same account after Star Wars came out, everyone would have been just, oh, sure, patted them on the head. You know, obviously, they just saw Star Wars.
Yeah, exactly. Lucas is on notice now. Yeah,
that's right. No, but it gives you this like very precise behavior and parameters of what this light was doing, which then you can go later and you know, look to advances in technology or what we know about lightness behavior and stuff and kind of see if you can map it onto anything. I always think of I think it's in Dimensions, I'm trying to speak more clearly, by Jacques Vallée.
Yeah,
trying not to say, you know, that guy Jacques Vallée. You may have heard of him.
You may know of him.
You listen to this podcast, possibly. So, in Dimensions, he talks about some historical cases of strange lights in the sky. And one of the ones he talks about is in Japan, I think, in like the Middle Ages of Japan. Anyway, these people are saying there was an object in the sky and it was glowing like a ceramic vessel that's in a kiln being fired.
Yeah.
And what was interesting to me about that is that, and I don't know the name for it, but that is a particular type of radiation, like it's a particular type of light being emitted when you are firing ceramics in a kiln. Mm-hmm. It's like it's a different type of radiation, like the sun makes a particular type of radiation, an incandescent light bulb makes a particular type of the light has a signature of this particular type of radiation versus a fluorescent light and so on. So I was thinking, you know, people, it's kind of like they could say, well, you know, it's just because they didn't know any better. I'm thinking, well, no, maybe that could tell us something about what was happening there. If it had, you know, what are the characteristics, the type of chemical processes that generate this particular form of light
mm-hmm.
or radiation.
Right.
But that made me think of this incident as well, because there and further on, it talks more about some of the qualities of light. And I thought these type of specific observations that, you know, this could be a clue as to what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And Yoli herself believed that this tube of light was actually composed of water. Not really that's sure. Trippy. Yeah, that's very true. That's very trippy because like, it doesn't say that they describe it as like, you know, like flowing or anything like that. But that's the kind of impression that I get, is that it, maybe you think like, I don't know, there's some like flow to it or something like that. And she thrust her hand inside of this beam of light. But she found that it wasn't really wet. Instead, it was like an intense kind of heat, but it didn't really hurt her at all. And then she just kind of pulled her hand away and ran back inside very quickly. The patriarch of the family desperately wanted to go out there to investigate, but his daughters held him back while his wife prayed. They too saw the slow moving beams of the light creeping along outside the window, and they described it as a 10-foot cylindrical tube of white light. Another beam of light emerged from another object further along the track, and it extended a shorter distance, but could be seen slowly approaching a chicken coop, where it stopped just shy and remained there stationary for a few minutes. And they go ahead.
No, here's the thing, because I keep looking at this, and there's kind of like the technical aspect and then the mythic aspect of these manifestations, or where these things happen, because all this activity is happening along this railway track and this road. Mm-hmm. So we have like travel between dimensions, or between wherever the other place and here is happening along roads and train tracks.
Yeah,
which you think, why would this be? I mean, you can say it could be that the, because of course there's certain geomagnetic properties associated with train tracks, all that metal, which is true, and that could have an aspect as well. But mythically, it's like communication between the realms is ruled for like by like Hermes, Mercury, and he is you know, the god of travelers and roads, boundaries. And the thing is, you think, you know, yeah, sure, whatever, this is a little bit cliche, but I was reading about, because I've had some intense dreams about him recently, and one of his sacrifices would be like a cock or a rooster. And this one light beam coming from the
interesting
going to the chickens.
Interesting.
That there is, are see, yeah. He's also hares would be a sacrifice to him. And Smiles Lewis of the Anomaly Archives has written up a couple of different things. One in particular about, I need to find this one. It's a wild case. Two sisters who are inside the house, young women, and they're kind of out in the country, and they are being like menaced or feel like they're being stalked, or they are prey of a UFO that is outside of the house. I believe they're two young sisters at home alone. And then there was a bunch of rabbits there, and they really, I think especially the one sister was really feeling like almost this kind of like a emotion meld with the rabbits in terms of just being the prey of this UFO.
Yeah.
And so, but then again, with rabbits and hares are again sacred to Hermes. So, but that's so weird because you would think, yeah, on the one hand, you'd think, well, this could be completely prosaic because they're attracted to the middle of the train tracks.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also this kind of symbolic aspect, too, that's very weird.
Yeah, absolutely. So there was also this kind of light that was flooding into the farmhouse itself, and the temperature rose above 40 degrees Celsius, or about 104 degrees. And when the children woke up the next morning, they were apparently all drenched in sweat. So, yeah. it was, UFOs, like, we're cool with the heating bill. Let's take it easy. You know,
no, that's really hot, you know?
Yeah. That's a bit much, you know,
and that's the type of thing where you're starting to wonder when it's happening. It's like, okay, how far are they going to take us? Cause you know, sitting here all these years later, we know what happened, but yeah, I mean, Dora, she severely burned. You don't, yeah. I can imagine being scared shitless and for good reason. Cause you have, who knows where it's going to go or what's going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. The matriarch of the family, Teresa, claimed that a shadow had passed in front of the window in her bedroom, which she watched many of the events through. But it wasn't sure, like maybe it was a hallucination or something. But like that aspect kind of terrified me a little bit because like it's a nondescript shadow. I don't know if it's like a figure, someone passing in front of the house or exactly what that is. But anytime someone says a shadow passed in front of my window, I am not a fan. But
no, that's fine. I don't mean you.
No. So they continue to watch in terror as this as the object closest to the house, the object Yoli referred to as La Nave Madre, or the mothership, because it was larger than the other ones that they could see on the tracks. It projected this slow moving beam of its own toward the town of Trancas at one point. And over the course of 10 to 15 minutes, it reached the outskirts of town. And then it retreated back to the object next to their home, which then moved in the direction of the railway line, and the other objects joined the larger one. And together they moved off toward the Sierra de Medina mountain range. And following the craft's departure, the Moreno family stepped outside, where the cloud that engulfed the mothership was still there and remained there for 4 hours. That's too much. That's too long. Like, how? Move on.
And the thing, because, you know, I live in California here in the Central Valley, and a lot of places we get these tule fogs,
mm-hmm.
which are like in low-lying areas, and we get a lot of advection fog too, rolling in from the coast. And so, you know, everyone's thinking about fog all the time, because especially the tule fog is weird. In the Central Valley, because it's a radiation fog. So basically it's like when the ground gets saturated and then it's at the right temperature, then suddenly this fog just, I mean, it doesn't even roll in from it. It just kind of like appears, manifests everywhere in these low spots. And so when you're in it, it can cause very severe accidents because, I mean, suddenly you won't be able, I mean, depending upon how bad it is, you might not be able to see 10 feet. So if you're going along the highway at 50 miles an hour or more, it can be very bad. So it's like weird. It's like meteorological, that was the word I was looking for, conditions would have to be very stable for a long time for that type of, you know, fog, if it was, you know, kind of that type of fog as opposed to, you know, whatever the hell else it was, to just be mm-hmm. hanging around there for that long.
Yeah. Yeah, you absolutely. And the next day in the same area, they discovered that where this craft had hovered, a perfect 30-foot diameter circle that was filled with half-inch white balls. And more of those would actually be found on the railway lines as well. And samples were sent to the Institute of Chemical Engineering at the University of Tucumán, where Walter Gonzalo Tell did an analysis of them, which showed that they were composed of calcium carbonate, about 96.48%, and potassium carbonate, 3.51%. The trees closest to the craft seemed to have withered a bit, and they did use fertilizer on them, and they did regain some ability to grow, but not quite the same as they had. And from this article, they were able to find additional eyewitnesses to some of this stuff. Quote, at 10:30 p.m. the same night, Senora Yoli Moreno went across to the house of their neighbor, Senor Francisco Tropiano, which lies about 100 yards to the north of the Moreno residence. She asked him whether he had noticed anything strange during the last few minutes. An object had been directing its solid beams right at Senor Tropiano's house. But Senor Tropiano said he had neither felt nor seen anything, as he had been fast asleep. All that he was able to do was confirm the presence of the orange glow, which still persisted in the east. Still bent on gathering additional details about the phenomenon, the Morenos questioned the overseer of their farm, Senor Jose Acosta, whose house lies to the west of theirs at a distance of 100 yards or so, but on the other side of an irrigation ditch. Acosta's own first question to them was why the field had been on fire, as he had seen that it was lit up to the east of his house. And I think what's interesting here is that there's another case from Aveyron, France, in the 60s. Can't remember the exact date, but the first witness to the specific phenomenon, which this family would have multiple sightings of, these kind of like globes, these kind of big balls of light that would just kind of roll around their property and stuff like that. The grandmother on this property said that she first thought that the property was on fire, and then she went to bed. Like,
yes.
Like, that apathy is just, it's always incredible when you read about it, because it's just like, why would you go to bed if you thought your farm was on fire?
Well, this is like a weird synchronicity I had like many, many years ago, kind of surrounding Mike Cleland of Hidden Experience. Mm-hmm. This is way back before he'd ever published a book or anything, and he was talking about some of his own experiences. And he had one, I believe it was when he was a kid, where he had seen like a line of grays, I don't know, it was like three or four, coming towards him from outside.
Yes,
and he saw them, and he was terrified. And then he's like, and then I went to sleep. Yep. So he'd written about that. And it was on my mind. And within the next few days, I had a book. I think it was one of Hynek's books or something on UFOs or flying saucers, I think, in the title anyway. Mm-hmm. And I went to get a new band put on my watch. And so I go into this jeweler's at downtown Walnut Creek. And the jeweler is there. And he looks at me and we say a couple things. And he said, oh, that book. He said, and I said, yeah, he's like, about flying saucers. I'm like, yeah. And he was from Central or South America. And he said, you know, when I was little, I saw them. I saw the gray, the aliens. And he said, I remember I was in my bed. I was little and I saw them outside my door. And I said, and then I knew in my head, it's time to go to sleep. So I went to sleep. So he told me the same thing that was on my mind from Mike's blog.
Oh,
this
God.
Guy I'd never met before, just because I've been carrying around it. So that always stuck in my mind. I don't know that I've personally ever had that type of experience. Usually when I have the feeling of another presence, which has happened to me on numerous occasions, like in my bedroom or something, it'll usually like I'll be woken up in the middle of the night and I'll be really awake. Mm-hmm. But then usually my sense is that it is humans as opposed to non-humans. I don't think I've ever had like any type of contact with like a being associated with a flying saucer or UFO thing or bright light in the sky.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Hey, you want another really weird synchronicity then?
Me? Are you kidding?
Yeah. Mike Clellan and his partner Andrea, they're bed and breakfast. It's in my hometown.
There you go.
His stories always freak me out, but you know, that is what it is.
Yeah. Well, he's the first person who ever published a synchronicity of mine on his blog, because he was talking about a dream that he had, and it reminded me of a synchronicity that I had with a hummingbird. So I just wrote it to him, and he's like, oh, can I put this on my blog? So yeah. Yeah. He's really, I admire him a lot. Mm-hmm. Because he's, you know, he has all these great stories and he manages to write them up, and he's very insightful and everything. But what really gets me is he's very kind and open-hearted and sympathetic.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. He absolutely is.
Yeah.
Mr. Acosta here, he'd seen this, you know, saying he had seen this field on fire, seeing that it was lit up to the east of the house. He added that he had, quote, amused himself watching numerous bright objects which were moving about for a considerable period of the westward, indicating that he had seen additional objects that the Moreno family didn't or hadn't.
This is another thing because, of course, Napa, we've had all these incredible firestorms that everyone has seen, all this crazy stuff the last few years. If you're living anywhere where fires are a thing, the last thing you're going to do is sit on your ass.
Yeah.
You think there's a fire anywhere near you.
Yeah.
Which is like so, because I mean, it sounds crazy enough, but then if you've actually lived through that, I mean, you're just basically shitting yourself, panicking.
Yeah.
Especially, I can't imagine, you know, being out there, because it's bad enough for us. We live just like a couple blocks from a literal fire station full of big fire guys. And I live in a 55 plus active living community. So those guys know the way here. And I admire them a lot. They've always been fantastic. They're great. But yeah, I mean, especially like you're living out in the country by yourself. That's completely unusual behavior. You're not going to be sitting around.
No.
Twiddling your thumbs.
No, you will not be a victim of the apathy.
So obviously there's an altered state of consciousness happening.
Yes. Another piece of unpublished testimony came from a lady physician, Dr. Renee Vera, doctor at the Trancas Hospital, which lies just outside of Trancas. On the night in question, her car broke down as she was driving towards Trancas. So she decided to finish the journey on foot. The time was about 11 p.m. when she saw coming flying over from west to east, or rather slightly towards northeast, a squadron of 40 or 50 luminous bodies which passed overhead at low altitude. They left the whole atmosphere. And this is interesting, given just like how we've talked about this. They left the whole atmosphere impregnated with the smell of sulfur to such a degree that she was almost made ill by it.
No, sulfurous fog is a thing, and it can it can damage your lungs.
Yeah.
Because the place that I used to live to before, we'd get these really strong sulfur smells. And one time I called the fire department because it was so bad. I was like, what's going on? And they said, no, it's just like certain areas that have a lot of sulfur in the ground and springs and stuff. If you get like a like kind of a layer of air that's just setting there and then it's coming up, it can get to a big concentration. Because I felt like an idiot for calling them because I was like, well, it's just, and I thought, well, it's just a natural thing. And they're like, no, you should call because it can actually damage people's lungs. You know, you can get into big breathing problems with it. So, yeah, I mean, that's a really incredible confirmation observation they were able to find from this doctor. Mm-hmm. But then also her talking about how sick she felt from it. It seems like the sulfur is really present. And then all these weird calcium balls all over the place. That's just really weird.
Yeah. Yeah. This incident was related to the Merinos by Dr. Renee Vera herself along. After the press reverberations of their own story had died away, she had not wanted to report it at the time out of fear of the usual ridicule that she would have incurred. And I mean, she's a doctor, so it's kind of not surprising in that way. According to Yoli Moreno, she was made to fill out a technical questionnaire for the Argentine Navy, as well as a test for the Pentagon, which is very interesting. But in certain South American UFO cases, you know, I think Virginia comes to mind. And I think there was that crash in Mexico in the 60s or something like that. I can't even remember what the name of the incident is, but it's like U.S. military is involved. It's always weird when the U.S. military is somehow involved in that, but it kind of isn't out of the realm of possibility here. So, you know, she was of Yoli Moreno was of the idea that this was actually a terrestrial craft because of the rivets that were on it.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. I totally see where she's coming from. You know, joining the long line of people like, you know, Stefan Mikulak, for instance, who, you know, walked up to a UFO and called out saying, "Hey, you Yankee boys, are you having trouble? Let's figure it out."
I know, the friendliest of UFO witnesses. No, I just love that because he's just like kind of going up like it's yeah, blah blah blah, and then suddenly, yeah, he got hit with the, it's like the fairy blast or when the shamans hit you with the shaman bone or something.
Or, you know, for a relatable way to put it, the UFO farted on him and it was terrible, you know?
Yes. Well, it is weird because this whole thing, it seems very much like a chemistry experiment.
Yeah.
The whole Chonkis incident with the lights and the clouds. It seems like something that like a physics or chemistry professor would do for the class to try and explain some principle to you. And then look afterwards, oh, you see all the calcium carbonate, all the potassium, whatever, has precipitated out because of this chemical reaction, but there were rivets on it.
Yeah.
It's really transdimensional, you know?
UFOs leaving all their crap around. It's terrible. Like, think about that for yourselves. Like, what's wrong with you?
It's crazy.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. So do we know if they had any, since we're talking synchronicities, do we have any reports from the witnesses afterwards or the family about any, like, sometimes people have like ongoing poltergeist stuff or weird synchronicities, telepathy, premonition, dreams, missing time, amnesia, weird things, alternate landscapes?
Not really that I could think of.
Just mania.
Yeah, there was nothing, there was no other additional information. And in like a lot of the there was a blog that I came across, like couple of years ago that I wasn't able to find when I was trying to put this together, that I think it talked to the witnesses like, you know, 40, 50 years later or something like that. I don't think there was anything significant in there, but I didn't see any, you know, additional contacts or anything like that. Cause like, it's just so random. Like, hey, here's a farm ranch out in the middle of nowhere. Let's just fuck with them. Why not?
Yeah, it's just like, let's put on this incredible, intense display with a lot of witnesses, confirming witnesses, a lot of, that's a lot of physical evidence or impact between Dora Martina and all the weird calcium, potassium balls on the ground, bombs at the trees. So, it's you know, a big bad sighting and a lot of information about the light and the motion and stuff, but it still is very enigmatic. You get these things and it's just like they say, it's like this huge big deal, and it has these big kind of themes that really tie in with the UFO lore or mythos overall. But at the heart of it, there is, again, this mystery. And I don't know, it's one of those ones that I would really like to know more about what possibly went on. I completely understand why people don't.
Yeah.
Because especially here, you know, these people are very educated and brave and forthright. And they've given very clear accounts of what exactly they experienced with excellent observations. So you're not going to want to talk about if you have, like, you know, poltergeist stuff afterwards or other weird shit. You don't want to start digging yourself into a lack of credibility hole after you've gone to all this trouble to be so clear about your experience. So I really can't ding anyone for it, but I would love to know, because this incident happened the better part of, like, almost about 60 years ago. And I know this because, of course, my brother's only a year younger than I am. Later on, they mention a couple of dates in this article. That one is 3 days after I was born, right? I'm gonna out myself now. May 12th, 1962, I was born on May 9th. So it was kind of like there's this whole kind of, like charisma or like a meaning vortex around this incident that is like reverberating out all this time later when we dive into it, right? Because I started sending you some of these synchronicities, not all of which we're going to get into. But one of them was, I was like, oh, and then later on, there's this other date. And it always reminds me of my sister because it's kind of related to her and my birthday together, blah, blah, blah. And that's when I wrote these synchronicities up. I was just like, oh, and so blah, blah, that was interesting that this was in here. And you said, well, that's my birthday.
Yeah, it is. My birthday's May 6th. So yeah.
And then we started having some other things that I don't know if we want to get it. I hate this when you have the really good ones. It's like, right. I don't know if people want to get this, but I had mentioned that May 9th, my birthday, I was born on John Brown's birthday, the abolitionist, and I guess that you live quite near.
Yeah, in the town of North Elba. Which is right outside of Lake Placid. Really, as you're, if I can picture this in my head, as you're driving towards Lake Placid, if you kind of like veer right and you keep driving towards the town of North Elba, what you will come across is that there is a, John Brown used to own a farm up in my neck of the woods, and he opened it up to Black people to come up and kind of like learn, you know, farming techniques and stuff like that. He actually called it Timbuktu. Oh, wow. Yeah, And he was given that property. He was sold that property by another abolitionist that I can't remember the name of, but, yeah, he just, passed it on to him, but it is a, you know, historical site, in North Elba.
Yeah. And, it's kind of funny too, cause, we're riffing on this whole kind of like birthday and the connection there, because a woman who is buried here in Napa in Tulare Cemetery, Mary Ellen Pleasant, she's known as the mother of civil rights in California. And she was a Black woman who passed as white in California until after the Civil War, in which and then she came out and said, yes, actually, I am Black. She had been making money, and then she started really pushing for civil rights legislation in California. But she was also a benefactress of John Brown and helped fund his activities. He was hanged. And after he was hanged, they found a note in his pocket, and it was from her, actually. So we have this kind of place, birthday connection between the two of us. And, you know, it went on to point to some other interests that we have in common. Which I don't think we want to get into, but I have a similar thing, because the thing that fascinates me about this is it's precise, but also has these more symbolic things about, like, the, you know, being near these sites of abolitionists and civil rights people. But it starts a long time ago. So I have an example where I can lay out more, if you like, how this type of thing can play out and how it's played out for me over a long time. So I was born in 1962. And George Hansen, the trickster and the paranormal guy, has found that there's a lot of paranormal people and ufologists and stuff that were born in 1962. So I'm one of them. I just wanted to... anyway, I went to college in the fall of 1980 at UC Santa Cruz. And at that time, I met one of my classmates. He was older, a guy named Alex Angel. Alex, but with A-N-G-E-L-L. So the extra L on the end of Angel. And it's a great name. And he was just like a really sweet guy, really smart, really friendly and mellow. And he was like super good looking and very... kind of stylish, cool. Actually, there's a couple old pictures of Jack Parsons, and he has very much that same look and kind of aesthetic. I mean, like that. I mean, you know, like that good looking and that cool and that charismatic. So we'd study together and stuff. And I was like, I still couldn't like figure out like why he wanted to study with me. But anyway, he was very nice. And then I guess he had graduated, but I always remembered him because he was just, he was just charismatic, but also just like a really sweet, nice guy. So I don't know, probably I don't know, like 7 or 8 years ago, I was listening. Actually, I think I was on Project Archivist. I was hearing about the Alex cast. It's my friend now, Alex Bolin. And the first thing I noticed was he spells Alex with two X's. And I said, oh, that's kind of like Alex Angel, but instead of the two L's, it's the two X's. Mm-hmm. So I kind of associated him with him. We ended up becoming friends. He's like he's a podcaster and has writes like magical realist fiction. He's a chaos magician. We just had a really nice friendship, and he has helped me a lot because there's certain ideas that I want to get across when I'm talking to people about para-weird stuff. For example, one time he had me and Professor Wham on to talk about spiritual friendship, you know, what to, you know, look out for and look for when you're working with other people on spiritual esoteric issues. So it was very important to me. And he just like gave me all his resources of podcasts and helped me record that with Wham. So things like that I really appreciate. And plus we have a very friendly, joking relationship. And then I don't know, a few years ago, I met, David Metcalf online. He's like, as it turns out, he's a much more prominent person. I feel attacked. he just became, the, Winbridge, virtual scholar in residence. And I wanted to make sure to get his title, his ceremonial title correct. on the show. But I was looking up at his CV. I was like, oh, this is a lot more extensive. I should have been showing him some more respect over the years. He's a very nice, very interesting, talented guy. But I always kind of linked him with Alex for some reason. I don't know, but I always had them as like a pair in my mind. Mm-hmm. And Metcalf has also helped me over the years with some of the, you know, appearing on some podcasts with me to help present some ideas that are important to me about synchronicity or multidisciplinary approach in the paranormal. And he's let me use actually some of his male modeling work on my blog, which I appreciate. I'd always kind of had him and Alex together, and then come to find out, okay, they were Alex and David Metcalf were both born within 2 weeks in the fall of 1980. Within at the same time, basically, that I met Alex Angel.
Mm. That's so weird.
Yeah.
That's very weird.
Yeah. And it goes back like 40 years. And on top of that, I have a dear friend from college. I actually met her the next year, my friend Mariana. She's an artist and very mystically inclined as well. And just more fun than a barrel of monkeys. she actually, her birthday is right around the same time that she's my year, but within that same couple of weeks time as Alex and David Metcalf. So these are the kind of ways that things can kind of come together, where you have like all these people that are very similar. You know, we all have these like joking relationships, and they're people that really help me in this aspect of my life. But it's like kind of like this one kind of moment where it all came together. I mean, it just trips me out that I would be meeting Alex Angel at the same time that like these two guys are getting born, right? They're going to be my friends later. And the other weird thing about Alex Angel is, because I said, you know, he looks like kind of Jack Parsons and people who I have an interest in sex magic and erotic mysticism. But he ended up becoming a teacher at Berkeley High School, and there was a big kerfuffle about him. I was looking him up online. There was a big kerfuffle about him a few years ago because he teaches history, and he brought a decommissioned bazooka to school, and he got suspended a little bit. But yeah, it's a rocket launcher. So there you have the Parsons thing, right?
Yep.
The other thing that gets me is I'm always concerned with synchronicities. I feel like no one's going to believe me that these things actually happened. And I was thinking, how could I prove that I knew this? Because I haven't seen him in a ton of years. I was thinking, how could I have any proof that this story that I'm talking about, knowing this guy at UC Santa Cruz, would have any basis in reality? So I looked him up online, and I found an article in the New York Times where he's talking about some business thing he's doing, and it lists his age and it lists that he was at UC Santa Cruz. So it places him there when I would be there. And it cracked me up because it's like the paper of record saying, yes, you're not full of shit and just spinning tails on this aspect of things.
It's always good when some type of print media can prove you right and not that you're, you know, prove that you're not the crazy person that think you are. Like,
I may be crazy for thinking there's a connection, but this did actually happen in consensus reality. You know, where you want to go for the meaning is, you know, beyond that. But I think in some of the, that was the weird thing too, is, you know, especially with the, like Alex Bowen, because it's like, I just made that connection right away. It was before we ever became friends or anything. And then, you know, when I met Metcalf, I'm like, I just kind of put him in the same mental file as Alex. And like lots of times I'd like, if I saw something that I thought that one of them would like, I, you know, like a picture or something, I'd send it to both of them. Cause I figured, oh, these are two guys together. So it's, but that's kind of how these things can kind of unfold, where the, it's kind of like these, birthdays or anniversaries or particular symbols are kind of like a clue to a human relationship. Getting back to my birthday, since that seems to be the theme. I've had certain men that are very important to me in my life that have either been born or died around my birthday. I had a near-death experience. I had chronic health issues through much of my life with breathing and stuff. And the doctor who saved my life then and pulled my fat out of the fire many other times, he was born on May 4th, 20 years before I was. So that's very close to my birthday. And May 4th is also the day that Alice went down the rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. And then two authors that are very important to me or have resonance. For example, Joe Fisher of Richard Haddam's writing about him. The spirits, he had the girlfriend from The Medium. I can't remember the name.
Oh, yeah.
The Hungry, Siren Song of the Hungry Ghost.
Yeah.
He died on my birthday. Another very influential book for me is The Harmonious Circle by James Webb, which is about Gurdjieff, what he could find out about his biography and his main disciples or students. It's a fascinating book. I've loved it for many decades. He died on my birthday. We had a family friend when I was growing up who was an artist, Corbin LaPelle. He went to school with Bruce Conner, if people know of the artist Bruce Conner. And I actually grew up seeing a lot of like Bruce Conner's work in his house. And so I knew him from the time that, you know, we were little kids in elementary school, and I actually ended up studying art, practical art with him in college for a while. But he ended up dying May 10th, which is just the day after my birthday. When I was in my 30s, I spent some time living in a Tibetan Buddhist meditation center. In the East Bay, we had a Rinpoche there, and he had been born in Tibet. He was recognized as a Rinpoche at a young age. He fled to America, and he ended up getting to California within about a week of the time that I was born. So it's just interesting to me how you can have these and some of these, like, you know, James Webb, I've been a big fan of his Harmonious Circle for about 20 years now. And I only found out very recently, like within the last several months, that he died on my birthday. So I don't know what it means, but at a certain point, you know, it's gonna attract your attention. So
yeah, that's a lot. And now I fit into that yes. circle of people. That's wild.
But we do have various interests, and we've had some great conversations behind the scenes. And yeah. I don't know. To me, it's like you were talking with A.P. Strange on a couple of shows, and I developed a friendship with him as well. Actually, it's funny, speaking of birthdays, because he at the beginning of the pandemic, he was having some Zooms that were just kind of like, you know, for people to chat because we're all cooped up. And so I went to one of the first ones that he had, maybe it was the first one, and I got there, I was the first person in, and I didn't really know anything about Zooms, but I happened to mention that it was my birthday, because it was my birthday, and he and Pam, his wife, sang me happy birthday, which I just thought was so sweet and so charming. But yeah, there's another birthday thing, because we have a big shared interest in like surrealist art and the role of humor in the paranormal, and art and the paranormal, the overlap there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to me that you have these dates, but they also point to these very intense shared common interests.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you know, there's a, you know, you get enough people together and you're going to have some dates that come together. As far as shared birthdays and stuff, I had a conversation once with a woman on a sewing forum about that, because we ended up sharing a birthday, and she's like, "Well, you know, it's like a 30 person rule. You have 30 people, and then in a room, let's say, and chances are that there will be two of them that share a birthday." And I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of people on this forum, but you know, how many people here, you know, we're actually like corresponding in meet space and sending each other stuff. We're not just on the forum. We have each other's phone numbers and physical addresses. So it's a little more.
That's how it happens, you know?
Yeah. And I think partly what interests me about it too is the whole, it's like a very kind of a, like a male female dynamic going on, right? Because it's like the young women who are capable of having babies go out there and confront this glowing sky and, and all the rays just keep coming.
Yeah.
More and more towards them. And then they're very, I mean, they get, they're, I don't, they're very brave. They really confront it. I mean, Yulia is putting her arm right into this beam.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very empirical, very curious.
That's bravery on a level that I don't think I would even come close to, you know, sharing at any point. I'm just going to say that I am never sticking my hand into any beams that are coming from a UFO. It just seems like a bad idea. But you know what? That bravery there, I respect the hell out of it. I respect the hell out of all those ladies. And it definitely made like the everything to do with this case is just absolutely like, from like the symbolism in it to like just like the actual kind of like the nuts and bolts within the symbolism, it's amazing how that kind of comes together into this like insane and unique UFO experience that I never really seen or heard of anything like it before or since, you know?
Yeah. Because like sometimes you'll find like a precipitation of weird stuff, or the vegetation will be affected, or there'll be these light beams, or they'll be confirmed. But it's like kind of all wrapped up into one. And I have to respect the family as well, because even though I would love to know all the weird stuff that may or may not have happened around this, if we look at most cases, how it goes down, there was a lot of weird stuff around it that I would love to know, but I really respect them for keeping their privacy. And I think that like in our conversation today, that's why I keep fudging a lot of this stuff, because for people to maintain their stability in the face of these type of events, you have to maintain your dignity and kind of fight your battles, know yourself and the people around you. And if you just go full tilt into it and especially let your emotions get out of hand, if you hand over your own sense of dignity and privacy and personal ethics or emotional well-being to other people or the press, and set yourself up for that type of judgment, take that type of judgment on board, it is just going to ricochet, because these type of events or UFOs, whatever they are, seem to really potentiate psi and emotion and symbolic content.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that may be in part their purpose, like a subtle or partly material machine for potentiating like mythic imagery.
Yeah.
And propagating it into the shared psychosphere. But yeah, I don't know. I think about that. Even just people who are just like not particularly out there as experiencers, but just kind of like to present themselves as straight researchers and stuff, I'll notice that they'll not want to talk about certain things or withdraw at certain times or not want to. And I think, and I've confirmed this with some people, that it's just to keep things from blowing up, you kind of have to manage. Actually, I wrote it wasn't me. I have a post on my blog called Managing Magical Reality, and it's an anonymous guest contributor, and they wrote about how they manage things themselves. Mm. And I think for everyone that this is part of what we do as we're engaging with this material, and we see like an event like this, you know, 60 years ago, it could still kind of have these ricochets with people in the present day. So I try and bear that in mind and not be too, not press people too much, mm-hmm. because they may have very good reasons for wanting to kind of, put things down.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. So it was synchronicities that brought us here, and yes. And has made for just an absolutely fantastic episode. So, Stephanie, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and talking about this insane case and just bringing a unique perspective to it. So where can people follow along with what you got going on and especially your blog, because your blog's fantastic.
Thank you. It's stephaniequick.home.blog is the address. The name of it is Ghost Dog is a Mystery Box. And I have my blog with articles, and then I have a contact information, and then a bunch of podcasts and video things there if people want to delve in. So yeah, that's probably the one place, one-stop shopping.
Absolutely. The one-stop shop for everything Stephanie Quick. You can find it there.
There you go.
As for the Our Strange Skies podcast, you can find us on most podcasting apps. And if you'd like to help us out, please leave a rating and review on the platforms that allow it. And tell your friends about us and all the amazing pods that you enjoy listening to. And if you want to support us monetarily, head on over to patreon.com/yourUFOguy. For $3 a month, you get early access to the episodes like this one. And there's also some Patreon bonus episodes that we have over there. And special thanks to Floats for the use of their song UFO as the theme for this podcast. And to Megan Lagerberg for our fantastic logo. And to the great Desdemona for our t-shirt designs. And finally, don't forget to look up, because you never know what you'll find in our strange skies or on your family's ranch in Argentina. In gray, we trust.
Media.